Hey, welcome to Black Law Tribal Edition. Bill and Gutton, Murray here with you today, and we've got Ganyara in the studio. And, well, it's been, I think in the Australian realm, they've had a few holidays here and there, so lots of things are going on, but it's been a bit quiet, I must say. But it's never quiet here in the office for the Sovereign Unity Government. And Ganyara, I guess one of the big news is that there's lots of happening around the world, and I noticed recently it was the largest gathering on Indigenous issues of more than 1,000 Indigenous participants across the world went and I think they travelled to Geneva or somewhere for the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and that was last week sometime, and it's continuing. Well, it's continued this week a little bit, and but it's interesting because it looks Indigenous because everyone's rocking up there with their traditional costumes, but they're acting in the wrong capacity. There's absolutely no way the United Nations can represent the Indigenous Nation, for example.
Oh, absolutely. When you stop and think about this, the United Nations are just the very definition of the word. You know, it's a group of nations that are united together under a common belief, a common law, an international law, if you want to put it that way. And the nations include people like the United States of America, Great Britain, you know, Commonwealth of Australia, New Zealand, all these sort of entities. And yet, in Australia, to give you an example, is that they say there's coexisting sovereignties. One of the Indigenous nations, you know, that's the one that coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. So the UN do not represent the Indigenous nations. They can't, especially in this part of the world called Australia. How can it be if there's coexisting sovereignty where you exist, the Indigenous nation exists under its sovereignty that's not of Australia? It's got nothing to do with Australia. They don't have a treaty with that sovereignty. That's why they're coexisting. So, yes, it is a bit of a mistake to think that if you're an Indigenous nation that the UN represents you. They actually don't. They actually are talking about you. And that's all they're doing. They just know there's this other group out there of Indigenous people around the world, and they actually do have a little fact sheet on that. And they do say that the Aboriginal people in this part of the world, in the Torres Strait Islanders, this part of the world, form part of that Indigenous definition, I suppose. You know, these are the people that were here pre-colonial, and they actually do state that, you know, the Indigenous peoples are those who are pre-settler, pre-colonial times. They do form minority because the colonial world has taken over and pushed out all over the world. They're still here in this part, what you want to call Australia, with the Australians still remaining here. Australians aren't Indigenous to any pre-colonial territory. They're not Australians. Are not citizens of Yidinji, for example. You know, this is a pre-colonial Indigenous nation that was here first. They're still here. They were never part of Australia, never allowed to be part of Australia, and thus they are not represented at the UN, the United Nations, as Indigenous people. You know, so Yidinji are not represented there to make sure of that. There, you know, we asked Australia to provide the document, the treaty, the formal agreement to where the Yidinji people have appointed the Commonwealth of Australia to be the representative nation for and on behalf of our people at the international realm. And there is none. We know that. But we just thought we better ask just in case one was done in secret and we didn't know about it. But they are not representing us at international law. They are talking about us. And the interesting thing is when they wrote a document like UNDRIP, the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, they actually make it very clear that there's two things in there. There's two entities. There's the Indigenous peoples. Go to Article 5, for example. You know, the Indigenous peoples have a right to revitalise all their stuff, bring back their institutions, their governments, their courts, their schools, whatever, you name it, they can bring it back, while they retain a right to participate, if they so choose, in the life of the state. Now, the state is the Commonwealth of Australia. We've got a right to participate there if we so choose. What if you don't so choose? You know, they can't force you into the life of the state in accord with Article 8. Now, this is from the United Nations, you know, the Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples, to which Australia supported in 2009. So they are talking about us. They're saying we can do this, we can do that, we can, and if we want to take part in Australia, we can. You know, but they can't force us to. We can go back to our sovereignty, the one that coexists with that of the Crown, and bring back, for example, our money, our banking, our land titles, you name it, we can bring it all back to life and revitalise it as long as we understand where the legal identities are. Now, all those people that are taking part in the permanent forum meeting the other day there, what you said, over 1,000, they all had to be seen through an international actor that's recognised by the international realm. So there was citizens of Australia there, for example, citizens of Canada there. I think, you know, the likes of Megan Davis. Now, she's a good Australian. She would have been there for sure on the permanent forum. I think she is on the board. So she's there as Megan Davis, not as the Indigenous woman whose nation owns the land where Australia is settled, but she was there as the Australian. And talking about issues that do affect Indigenous peoples, but they can't enforce or make any law for us. You know, we're outside their realm of sovereignty. Something that Australia, or a lot of people don't realise, is what the UN is. The UN is a body of international law made up of member states, you know. So there are the UN citizens, the international citizens that take part in this, and they actually hand up some of their sovereignty. So Australia has handed up some of its sovereignty to the United Nations, for example. You know, the new declarations on coal, for example, or asbestos, you know, where they said asbestos has got to be gotten rid of, get it out of circulation. So Australia give away some of its sovereign right about asbestos, for example, or nuclear fuel or nuclear weapons. This is where it all takes place. So you're actually handing up sovereignty. The Indigenous tribes haven't handed up sovereignty. They're out on their own.
Yeah, I think one of the other actors there is Dr. Hannah McGlade. She's also, I think she's based in Western Australia. Very, very knowledgeable on women that we've just mentioned there, and I think that's the deal with this. I think Yidinji's happy for them to do that through a formal agreement. That is, because there's many specialists that we don't have, for example, here on the territory. But at the same time, where there isn't those specialties, where we have to create that pathway for our young people to fill in those positions here. I was just thinking about the election. It hasn't been much talk about this and that. All I know is that the Greens have said that they want this treaty first and truth and or something like that. I can't really remember, but it's not an election issue, put it that way. But I think for me, what's happening in the Pacific is far more interesting, in that now not only Solomon Islands but other Pacific Islander nations are questioning Australia's role and whether they actually have a genuine interest, let's say that. One of the articles that you posted recently was an article from, I can't remember which organisation, but basically saying that Australia, I'm laughing not in jest here, but in this bit of a shock really, that the Solomon Islands, Australia offered fruit picking opportunities, while China offered economic, you know, benefits and stability. This is an article in the Sydney Criminal Lawyers. .com.au. So it's their article. It wasn't put together by our Attorney General. But look, it seems very, very, let's say, believable that Australia did offer fruit picking to those little natives over there from the Solomon Islands, because, that's been the, from what I gathered from many different nations around the Pacific, Australia's a bit of a I don't know what you describe it as, but a bit paternalistic, I guess. In some, yes, there's genuine interest there. There's been policing and information sharing, but fruit picking, you got to be serious.
Well, doesn't that sound like the good old cotton picking days? You know what I mean? They don't think that the people of dark skin have the ability to be able to engage in a more, I suppose, meaningful way of life, other than the menial labour that's out there. You know, you come and pick our fruit for us, you know, at a dirt cheap rate. You've got to work hard. You don't get much money. What a good life you're going to have here. And then as soon as your visa's up, you're out, you know. So I know I've spoken with a few of the Solomon Islanders around, you know, or there's actually quite a number of other islanders as well from Vanuatu and all around. They're here. And they do send the money back home. There's no two ways about that. They're looking after their family, but they're not stupid people. These are the people that I'm talking to are very well educated. They're not stupid, just fruit pickers. And that's what Australia can offer. And yet China comes along and then says, well, look, you know, we can do a bit more for you. You know, we can start to develop your nation a bit more because the likes of the Solomon Islands are very, very rich in mineral and other resources. And China can see this. But Australia is trying to be I'm the big white boy here. And actually, there was an article, I think, going back a few weeks ago there, that people of colour are disadvantaged inside Australia to advance to the top of the tree, so to speak, you know. It's more, you know, the boys, you know, the white boys get the jobs type, you know, in Parliament, for example, in politics. When was the last, black prime minister? You know, this is really deadly serious stuff. You know, they look down upon the Aboriginal people here. They always have. You know, Isaac Isaacs and H.P. Higgins at the turn of the last century said, you know, these Aboriginal people are a dying race. They're a little more than, you know, they couldn't cast an intelligent vote. This is that white Australia mentality, the white Australia policy. They're still here today. And that's why it is so hard for people of colour to advance up the tree in politics, for example, get right to the very top. You know, have a look at it, very white orientated. So this is just a reflection of that. But China come along and had done a good deal there for the Solomons, by the sound of it, nothing to do with us. But what Australia got to be careful of, and I'm going to say this very, very carefully, so that people can understand this, and I want the leadership of Australia to hear this as well. Australia does not have a treaty with the Indigenous nations. Now, if Australia keep treating the Indigenous nations like second-class citizens, you know, a little more than cotton-picking boys or fruit-picking boys, be careful of China or one of the other nations, UN member state, doing a treaty with one of the pre-colonial Indigenous nations who haven't ceded their sovereignty yet. We actually mentioned this to a couple of senators going back, 4 or 5 years now. One of them actually said to us, yes, you've got every right to do this, but please don't do it just yet. We actually said that sovereignty hasn't been ceded, which means we have a right to cede some of our sovereignty to, in whole or in part, to whoever we like. And Australia is not the guaranteed golden-haired boy, so to speak, to have this bestowed upon them. Now, she did say yes. You do have that right. She's a lawyer. Yes, you do have that right. But please don't do it just now. Please wait to see if we can get our house in order, to see where it all lies, you know. But we know you can do it. You know, so there's nothing to stop the pre-colonial Indigenous nations to cede some of their sovereignty to China, for example. Think about that. I keep saying it time and time again. What will be the legal situation in international law to which... Say land was ceded to China, some territory or some authority was ceded to China. China would be able to go to the international courts and say, look, we've been appointed through treaty to the sovereignty that coexists with that of the Australian Crown. We've been appointed by them to come and protect and develop their territory and resources. How will Australia respond to that? How will the Commonwealth of Australia respond? They won't. They can't in the international courts.
No, they cannot, and this is an interesting situation that's brewing at the moment. And like the Solomon Island situation, they said that this wasn't done in secret. The signs were quite clear in the lead up to that. Now that article you can read on the is written by a gentleman by the name of Paul Gregoire. He's a Sydney-based journalist, I think. And writes about a number of issues, mainly social justice stuff. But sydneycriminallawyers.com.au, just type in Solomon's fruit picking, and I'm sure you'll grab it off the internet there. But very interesting. Like I said before, one of the High Commissioners, George Brandis. George was the former Attorney General under Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull, and he currently holds the office of High Commissioner in London for Australia. And his time is up, so he's coming back. He's was a former senator for Queensland, and I'm hoping that he might come and pop a visit here, because I think he's an interesting character. But given his recent work in the free trade agreement with the UK and Australia, and promoting a lot of that kind of stuff going on, I'm wondering what he would be saying about Yidingi at those dinner tables and unofficial meetings behind closed doors, because he is a I've met him a few times now, and he's a very clever chap, a very interesting fellow. But it'll be interesting to have a chat to see whether he has been talking about the current situation, the insecurity that the Commonwealth of Australia is currently not enjoying or enjoying. But anyway, I think the writing's on the wall now. It's only a matter of if not when. Rather when, but not if, because the Yidingi Nation's moving forward. As we mentioned last week, the European Union, which is represents all the states of Europe, all the nation states, they're communicating with us now. Various other UN member states are communicating with us now, so it's too far gone. They know it's real, our government's real. They know that the situation is fast learning, that the Commonwealth of Australia does not have consent from the original nations, that is the pre-colonial Indigenous nations on this continent. They don't have a deal to reside here. And it's interesting. I think that this next year or two is going to be absolutely a humdinger, where other nations now here, we're talking about forming their governments. And that's a good thing. And, you know, as we've been saying here, it's to look after old Aussie. It's not to knock them off their perch or anything like that. We're happy for people to do those things at the international law level, but there has to be a fair dinkum approach to it as well. And, you know, the rule of law is quite important, I think. So, anyway, you're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition. We'll be back after the break.
No need to make a fuss. It's the thing we got going in for. with gold. Only one thing that I know. Secrets come, secrets go. Only one thing that I know. Got a secret, gotta keep it down low. Got a secret, babe, let nobody know. Got a secret, you gotta keep it down low. Got a secret, babe, let nobody know.
Hey, welcome back to the program. Listen, we've been talking a bit about the different sovereignties and the different nations that exist. And today we're talking to representatives from the Kanjun Nation and Kumun Nachawanta, rather, and from the Kanjun Nation. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marama.
And tell us, well, first of all, to our listeners, where is the Kanjun Territory? And, you know, obviously using the Australian descriptions, people might get to know it because it might be quite a foreign concept, even the name Kanjun. For people down in Sydney and Melbourne or even in Cairns, maybe they don't even know the word Kanju. But where is your territory?
Kanju is a language word for belonging. And Kanju Nation is situated from just north of Colne to up through the McIlwraith Ranges on the east, across to across the Peninsula Development Road into the west. Just as a brief description, and Kanju territory goes right up to Batavia, encompassing both the Archer River catchments and the Wenlock catchment.
And this is, for those listening, this is in the area described by many Australians as Cape York or far north Queensland. Very beautiful country up there. And describe the country for us, for people who haven't been there.
Many different landscapes exist up there. We can come into rainforest country. Parts of those rainforests are still connected to what they call Guana land. But you have riparian rainforests, open bushland, savanna country, quite beautiful, beautiful country. We've got many, many springs, many waterfalls. Much of the water shed running back to the west coast all the way across. So those that know where central Cape York is and know both of those catchments of the Wenlock and Archer, they run a fair way across out into the Gulf.
Yeah, these are very ancient rainforests, and I'd say that, you know, maybe they're, or maybe even now, there might be one or two few cassowaries there, I'm not too sure, but definitely in the past there would have been cassowaries there, because I've heard stories about that, not only here, but in the Northern Territory as well. They used to have cassowaries from a long time ago, from the Yolngu actually saying that.
Yeah, well, there's Mkutani, we call them, the cassowary. You know, there's a large population up there. Many new species, as you've pointed out. It's a very, very ancient land, and we're finding new species of different geckos and you know, beautiful, beautiful wildlife, the rifle birds that do the dance, collector's parrot, the nullabidgee, couscous couscous, as some people call them too.
Yeah, I would say that is it predominantly flat? The majority of your territory is quite. You've mentioned a couple of ranges there, but is it mixed throughout, or is it mainly flat?
No, it's mixed. We've got like the open bushland, and because there's so many waterways that runs through that catchment, it is it's rough and tough terrain to go through. So no, not flat like desert country. Yeah, mixed, really mixed.
So let's get into sovereignty now. Why has the Kanju gone down this sovereignty path, and what does sovereignty mean to you?
Sovereignty means our real independence. It means our real freedom under our law. It's revitalising and repatriating that law that's always been here and that's still now. There's many family members that are of Kanju descendancy that are all across this whole country. And many talks, like my mob, Nacha mob, Scrub Turkey mob, it's funny how Nacha, Scrub Turkey, you can go to anywhere in this country and you can see that bird and that Scrub Turkey and know that he's his native, but you'll see him in the main street of Sydney, you'll see him in the main street of Brisbane. That's us, that's Nacha. We are connected in such a way that so many of us that are across this whole nation, even in other parts of the world, of Kanju descendancy, we dream. Our spirit is still there, it's still inside us, it connects us. Doesn't matter whether we're there physically, our spirit is there, and that's what brings us home all the time. And that's what the repatriation of sovereignty means to me and many of my family.
Yeah, it's excellent. And the Kanju Nation obviously is trying to formalise relationship with the Yidinji Nation through the Yidinji government, and that's something very exciting for us. I guess what are the elders saying up there? Because obviously they'd be putting their support behind it. I think a majority of people want the best for their country and looking after it and things like that.
It's funny that you ask that question because it's... Our elders, we're getting a mass influx of elders, of Kanju elders right across this nation, that are putting their support behind us. Many of those that are still inside Cape York, and I don't want to talk about other processes or run other processes and stuff down. This just is what it is. Many of us that have been in Cape York, lived in Cape York, have watched elders go now and pass on without going back and touching their nachi, their country back home. Our elders are now getting behind this process because the fact that we don't want to fight in the same way that so many other processes caused us to fight. They like the peace. They like the fact that this feels right within our puya, in our heart. So, yeah, our elders are with us, those that have gone before us. We're coming into a realm of where our families, our children's, they're all little now. They're the ones that we're fighting for, and that's why the elders are coming with us.
One of the, the duties of heading down the sovereignty path is having a look at a number of different ways of going about it. What have you looked at? And what struck a chord with you in terms of the way that Yidinji were doing stuff?
Oh, look, I think there's a as researchers and people that are, feel as though in the past we've been stuck in a vortex that just goes round and round in circles and causes a lot of anguish and hate and anger. We've had a look at that's caused us to research different models around sovereignty and what it means. So we've looked at heaps of different stuff that's still good, still very in some times the research is showing us stuff that's quite extreme or radical. I don't believe we're going to get down and we're going to find us to go down a radical path as other sovereignty models have. I think the Yidinji model and the way that your elders, your old people and stuff have been driving this process here is the model that we like in our elders. And once, we all know each other, we're all brothers, whether we're black and white too. We got brothers and we got family that are finding a piece in the model that that's being presented by you, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I think people find it familiar because it reflects something that's very similar to their own societies, and Kanju being that, you know, there was, you know, when we look at the history books, for example, you know, we didn't have mass prison systems and all these other things that, you know, become, you know, sadly a hallmark of the Australian way of life, you know, a lot of Indigenous Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders inside of the Commonwealth finding themselves in these positions now. And, you know, that's what I think this opportunity now to reset the clock a bit and start from scratch, but not only for Rasmol, but for, like you said, for anyone, whether they be, doesn't matter the colour of their skin, if they wanted to become a Kanju citizen in the future through their government, then it's something like here we do with the Yidinji, but that's their under the direction and of the tribal council and the elders, for example. I think it's a very important thing. What more did you have to say on that?
Just hearing you talk about it, I mean, we have our own laws. You know, this is a repatriation of that law, and that law is based on good values, good principles, strong, staunch. Do not kill. Do not commit adultery. All of these things, and it's that realm of our sovereignty government that will bring that back. So we want to be a staunch, strong model around core principles and values as human beings.
Yeah, I think that spiritual factor is a huge one. And that enables, what it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the elders there are now saying we need to put that into the written context and codify that so Kanju can identify using its instruments, its identities, whether it's a driver's license or something else that's specifically created by and for the Kanju territory, the nation and the society, as opposed to using an Australian one or a Chinese one or a Yidinji one, for example.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at this instrument here on the table, that law, it come out from Bora. Bora was the drum. And, you know, I think there's so much of that, many think that we've lost, that we don't know. There's so much of it that we still have, that we know, and those things are about to come back.
So, what did you and the others that are involved with this journey now? What is something that you're striving for? You know, let's say in the next 5 years, where would you like to be, and how do you see that working with the Commonwealth of Australia, if that's what you know that the intention is?
I think it's really about us not pushing people aside. We've got there's conflict and conflicting issues and concerns and stuff. It ain't about pushing anybody out. We don't want to follow the same models that we've dealt with in this country for some time. It's caused too much hurt. It's caused too much heartache for so many of us. But I think for us as a government, where we will be striving to get to is to have our law, our ministers put back in place. We will strive to have our own enforcement. We will strive to have our own monetary put back in place, and non-Indigenous, well, the government calls it a torrent system. Well, we want to be able to bring about our own torrent system under our law and repatriate those things with our elders sitting in our tribal law.
Yeah, it sounds very exciting. The land titling with the Kanju seal or the Department of Lands and Planning issuing those titles. And look, this has got. I'm glad you've mentioned that, but I'll talk about it this way. You know, people that in the Australian realm, whether you're working for, let's say, the Queensland government, it could be for McDonald's or even the Land Council, I think it's really important that we're there to look after them, but to make sure that, you know, they do serve the interests of the tribal nations and the sovereignty that pre-exists and continues to exist here. And all the top constitutional lawyers and anyone that goes down this track will absolutely support and does already, not only Kanju or Yidinjis, but anyone else is listening out there that is from a pre-colonial Indigenous nations on this continent, for example. Nothing's been lost, and that's a very important message. And I think that's quite a refreshing thing to tell not only the old people, but the young people coming through as well, bro.
No, 100%. As I stated earlier, look, there's so much of a connection that we have with our homelands, with our nation, with our old people. I mean, there's stuff that we've seen. I'll share this. Is I don't remember my dreams. I don't know why. The only place I remember my dreams is up home on my land, on my Naachi. I don't know why that is. I can't explain it. But the stuff that I've seen around our governance, our law, them old people that come, like anybody that sees the stuff that I see when I'm back home, and even here I still have that connection to it. It's just exciting times, and I've never felt such a peace about it.
You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today, thanks to the Yidinji Broadcast Service. My guest today is Kumin Nachawanta, a member of the Kanju Society, and that Kanju Society, through the elders, is looking at setting a legal personality that's created by and for and subject to the laws of the Kanju Nation. And it's very exciting to be speaking with you today. What's your message for those people out there who might be sitting on the fence about this or a little bit afraid of it, or maybe they don't have enough belief in it? What's your message to them today?
One of the most important things I've ever learned is just patience. Learn patience. The challenges that some of this sometimes brings about is feeling like you need to jump straight across to no complete identity at all. Look, I love this country. I love where we sit. I've got so many valuable friends that I'd never change and ever replace. Those that fear this space, bear with us and just be patient with the process. We're going to be there. We're there for every single one of us together as a nation, as a Kanju nation.
That's it for now. We're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition. We'll be back after the break.
Mala. pretend that we live the past. We can do the dab or the dab is past. Let's go. Oh, that's a vibe. No stopping when a brother hit it, let the slide. OG's two stepping, rocking side to side. Let loose, let your body in the beat collide.
Don't let that fear hold you back. Let the rhythm inside.
Yeah, welcome back. Ganyara, I guess closing comments for today. You've just heard the interview there with Kumanan Chawanta from the Kanju Society, and very exciting that they're actually looking to form government, and that's something that behind closed doors Australia will probably be celebrating, because it's something that when these true and correct nations come back, it's something that they can actually come to and talk to and learn from, and not only that, gain consent for this treaty process.
Oh, look, absolutely. It's all about learning who you are and who you're not. But Australia really need, and I say this, Australia really needs all these Indigenous nations to come back, because how do they get true and correct consent? You can't get it from an Indigenous Australian, as John Howard said back in the 90s. You know, an Australian can't treaty with itself, so Australians have no right. And I'm talking about the Australian identity, not the man or woman, but the Australian identity has no right to speak for and on behalf of a pre-colonial Indigenous nation. There's no way they can legally, technically, or anything. So what's going to grant Australia any longevity here or any security? It's going to be the tribes in their true and correct capacity under the sovereignty that coexists with that of the Crown. And the more these nations do this, you know, we can't speak for their part of the world. There's no way I'm going to go and venture into there and do a treaty for and on behalf of their people if you're Yidinji, because, you know, you're going to breach every tribal protocol known to mankind, and, you know, the death penalty probably does apply at that level too. So you've got to be very careful. I'm glad to see these people coming back and getting the understanding of it and bringing back to life their ancient old laws and rules that have never gone away. This is really, really important, not only for history of Australia, but for the history of their own people. And it gives their kids something to look forward to in the future. It gives them some control or some say over land that hadn't been ceded in part or in whole. You know, there's no treaty yet anywhere with anyone. So it's good to see these people coming back. I really welcome it and I applaud it. Needs to be more of it around Australia. It is growing. But just getting the understanding of this stuff is that you are not the identity. Just understand who you are.
And brother said it during his interview as well about there's a sense of relief, because it doesn't have to be going and preparing for a fist fight every time you come across these things. There's an actual security level that the nations possess that is, indefeasible or immutable, for example.
Oh, absolutely. I thought when you said fist fight, I thought you were talking about ATSIC days or native title stuff, you know, whatever. That's what Australia want. While the mobs are fighting, they're not going to unify and build a nation. So it's good to see the, you know, just to walk away from the fight. That's how you defuse an argument, just walk away. But go and do something that's more constructive, and that is to bring back to life, revitalise that ancient old law that's always been there, you know. Just read Articles 3, 4 and 5 of UNDRIP, the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples. They got every right to revitalise all their stuff to self-government, to self-autonomy. There's no argument there. The United Nations agree. So where's the argument? You know, they can do this stuff, and they don't have to be forced into the life of the state if they don't want, you know. Article 8 of the same document, Australia can't force to assimilate. But the one that's going to be a real big kicker for Australia, and, you know, this is something that Yidinji actually said back in 2017, Article 28 can't apply. Australia cannot afford to pay our lot out. If they pay us all their money and we get settled, well, how do they get settled? So we're going to go back to the underwriting of Australia, go back to where our true and correct capacity is. Let's build Australia great if Australia want it. But remember, we can't hold out the olive branch forever. You know, we're doing that now to try and minimise the impact on the Australians. But if Australia don't want the deal, if they don't want the treaty, well, there's always someone else out there that may want it, you know, and they're whinging about China and the Solomon Islands at present. You know, if I was the American military, I'd have diplomats out here right now going around all the Indigenous tribes saying, hey, look, what's the deal with Australia? Have you got a treaty with them yet? And if not, we'll negotiate one with you, just so they can secure their interests. Because there's a lot of interest, like, look at Pine Gap. What if that lot over there, at Pine Gap in the Northern Territory, said, look, we'll do a deal with China to give them the lease on Pine Gap. The Western world is blind in the South Pacific. The Indian Ocean, if that goes, because China will be able to take it to the courts, the international courts. Think about the consequences. So really, the big military superpowers need to get there to pull Australia into line and get them to do something.
Yes, that's it for today's, this week's program, rather, today's conversation. But listen, may God's peace be upon you wherever you are listening to this program. I hope you found it enjoyable and informative. And in the mighty name of Yeshua HaMashiach, we'll see you next week.